much time do you want to reserve?
Just 3 minutes again.
Okay. So before you address whatever you're going to address with the plea agreement, what's the case that you're citing? Firseth? Is that what the case that you want us to follow?
Firseth is one of them, and it's cited in my reply brief, so it's
okay.
There. But, yeah, Firseth. And that applies to this case we're talking about right now, too.
No, I know. That's why I thought I could ask for a clarification. So you're relying on Firseth to say that we should follow same criminal conduct analysis.
Well, let me refine that a little bit, Your Honor. I'm saying we can look to Firseth as a kind of a signpost in terms of figuring out let's put some meat to this factual analysis. Let's put some actual standard to it. And we look at some, not just Firseth, but there's other cases too, McReynolds, I think even Hall. They're using this language of continuous course of conduct. And I'm saying that we can look to the unanimity cases and dealing with that issue as at least a guide to how we're treating the factual prong of the analysis.
But continuous course of conduct as a legal question, factual question?
As a factual question.
As a factual one,
but to put some actual legal analysis behind that factual question, if that makes sense.
Well, we've got Morales.
We do have Morales, yeah.
So Morales says same time, place, threat.
Yeah.
So why would we look to these other cases? I mean, why? Because we have Morales telling us what to look at.
Well, we have Morales telling us what to look at based on the particular facts of that case, though. We have another factual scenario here, so I'm suggesting, well, we need to broaden our horizons in terms of the standard that we're looking at, if all we do is say, well, Morales went so far, didn't go any further.
Right.
Then, well, yeah, France loses, because I mean, the facts in this case are different than the facts in Morales. I mean, we have a longer time span and so forth. I mean, it's a different factual matrix. What I'm saying in determining that, the answer to that question in France's case, we can look to the unanimity cases, at least for some guidance. Just as, say, for example, if you look at what the Supreme Court did on Villanueva Gonzalez, I think it is, again, cited in my brief. That's a unit of prosecution case dealing with assault.
Mm-hmm.
And
in that
case, they're setting forth some different factors that can be considered on the factual aspect of whether it qualifies, as the assault qualifies still.
Okay.
And they kind of track the unanimity, continuous course of conduct cases. And so, again, that's why I'm drawing upon this idea is to say, well, look, I mean, in this case, we're talking about now the plea case. I mean, we've got multiple threats. Yeah, did they occur on the same day? No, they didn't. Well, actually, some of them, at least as originally charged, did occur on the same day. But as they ended up being pleaded to, they occur on different
days. Well, isn't that all we focus on? Because you're challenging the convictions, which is now we get to the state argues you waived. So I will ask the state when they get up about why the state's taking the position. We wouldn't address that first. But what's your response to the argument that Mr. Franz cannot collaterally attack his plea agreement?
My response is this issue's been settled already in France's favor. I mean,
France's?
Yeah, in France. Yes, in France's. That's drawing from Knight. This court in Martin.
So what Knight says is, well, Knight and Hughes and other cases say now, and this was evolving, and I don't think we would need to go through the tortured history of how the court arrived there. But as I understand it, when you enter into the plea, you do agree to the factual basis for the plea. There's no question about that. But that doesn't bar a double jeopardy challenge because double jeopardy is challenging the convictions. Do you agree with that?
Yes. I mean, that's
and the, that's your position.
In a nutshell. Yeah, that's my position. I mean, I think it's fairly, it's clear.
That's fine. That's so then now you can move back to your unit of prosecution.
You can give him a hard time on that one. But, but no, that is the position.
I just wanted to get waiver down.
Okay, good. So I believe we were talking about, So I was saying, okay, so in this case, there are a bunch of calls in this case.
We have three victims.
We've got more calls than were actually charged at all.
Well, but we ignore those. I think we just
We
just look at the ones that he pleaded guilty to.
And I'm saying we don't ignore that. We don't ignore that for two reasons. One is that we're looking at unit of prosecution analysis and what it's supposed to guard against arbitrary charging decisions.
Oh, okay.
We have to take into context that there were other potential charges available here under the state's theory anyway.
More than, because wasn't the original charge 15 counts and he pled to 9?
I believe it was 16,
okay,
and he ended up pleading to 9.
So you're saying there could have been more than 16?
There could have been more, and it's relevant to this idea of, okay, why isn't the state's charging decisions in this case arbitrary? Is it arbitrary?
Or
seemingly it is, because it could have charged a lot more. Mm-hmm. Why did they choose the dates that they did? And that goes to the factual prong, too. I don't know. I mean, it's something to reflect upon, because if we just look at the counts that he was pled guilty to, right, and then we turn to the factual prong of the unit of prosecution analysis, and we say, there's 2 weeks separating this threat here, and there's, 3 weeks here. It doesn't seem like continuous course of conduct to me. But then if you step back for a moment and think, well, wait a second, though, there's actually, if you look at all the threats that were actually made, Hall does that, for example, in a witness tampering case. Over a thousand, attempts to tamper in that case. Mm. And the court took it, of course, only, three were charged. But the court took those uncharged criminal acts into account in determining whether there's a continuous course of conduct there. France asked the same in this case. Take him into account. Why isn't it arbitrary what the state did here? The state originally charged stalking for each of the three victims in this case, which makes a lot of sense. Repeated harassment, that's stalking. France doesn't go for that in terms of pleading guilty, so what does the state do? Stalking's off the table. Now let's stack them up on these 16 counts of harassment. Increase the punishment. That's what they did. That's a problem under the unit prosecution analysis. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Dennis McCurdy for the State of Washington. Let me answer a couple of the court's questions first. I forgot earlier you asked about double jeopardy in other contexts for felony harassment.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
There was a case, because I was the deputy. It's either Mandanus or Meneses. It was a Supreme Court case. It dealt with assault in the second degree and felony harassment and the firearm enhancements.
Mm.
I took it over for Lee Yates, but on the Westlaw, if you just did my name, it's one of those two. And then as I recall, they raised it at oral argument. I can't remember if it's in the court's decision, but then it went back for resentencing, and they appealed again. And I know that the Court of Appeals case dealt with double jeopardy. What I don't recall is if it's a published decision or not. And I simply don't recall, but I know that that case did deal with it. First, Seth, I don't know. I happen to be the deputy on that, too. I don't know how that helps the unit of prosecution argument for the defense. That's a possession of child pornography case. And it had to do with the fact that the Supreme Court had changed the unit of prosecution for possession of child pornography under, I think it was the name of the case, was Sutherland or something along those lines. And the question in Furseth was, did we need a Petrich instruction? The state's argument was no, because the Supreme Court has said it's one unit of prosecution no matter how much child porn you possess. The statute's since been amended. So that doesn't, that doesn't help us here one way or another. A couple other points I want to make is one of the critical things about Morales is the flaw that they make in basing their determination on assuming the term knowingly threatens is plural. And as I point out in my brief, that's incorrect. Threatens is a verb, not a noun. The noun is threat, and threat is singular.
So is threat the focus of the statutory analysis on the legal prong here?
I believe so. The statute is lengthy, but the only part that's operative for our purposes is knowingly threatens, and how is that defined? Threat is defined by statute as well, and so that's the language we would be looking at. I also wanted to point out, the defense tries to contrast all of these cases dealing with no contact orders because he says, well, the court said that's singular, that it can be charged as a single offense. Well, the problem with that is the Washington Supreme Court said the same thing about harassment in the Alvarez case. They also said that case, in Alvarez, they said a single act can constitute harassment. That doesn't answer the question of what the unit of prosecution is. But the one thing it does do is it destroys the defense argument that you're trying to look at those types of cases, the no-contact order cases, and say, see, there's the difference, because that difference is ameliorated by Alvarez. The exact same thing that's relied upon in Brown, Parmalee, and Allen is the exact same thing relied upon in Alvarez. That doesn't mean it's one continuing course is the unit of prosecution. I'm not going to talk about the plea aspect in a tremendous amount of amount.
Well, I do need clarification about sure. What your position is on waiver, because you're taking the position, well, two questions I have. One, absolutely. You say we don't need to reach it if we get to unit of prosecution. I don't know why, because it seems like it's a predicate issue that we would need to address. But secondly, you argue, well, you've waived because you agreed to the criminal history.
Right.
I don't see how that squares with Knight and Hughes and what the Supreme Court has said.
Well, first of all, let me go back to the first part. The reason is so you don't need to reach it. It is a more complicated issue. My point is, if this court rules in my favor, consistent with Brown and Hall and Parmalee and Allen, then it's a moot point. You don't need to address it because we know the unit of prosecution is each individual act, and there's no question these were separate acts. So you don't need to go to fact challenging the plea. It would be a moot point. Yes, technically, I guess you would look at the can you challenge the plea first, but that only makes any difference is if you buy the defense unit of prosecution, because then you would be looking at the facts. So it's, you know, that's why I'm saying you wouldn't have to deal with the issue of whether there's waiver or not. But to me, this is different than Knight and Francis, the two key cases the defense relies upon. And you can't allow a defendant to go into open court and promise conditions of his plea deal, a contract, as the case law has talked about, and then turn around and violate the plea deal. Now, Knight and Francis are not those cases. Knight, the issue in Knight was the plea deal was simply that the defendant testify against the co-defendant. And the Supreme Court said he did that. He fulfilled his part of the bargain. Therefore, his challenge to it, to the plea, is not waived. In Francis, there's a little bit different because the court's opinion, the court says, the mere act of pleading guilty does not waive a double jeopardy challenge. Now, pleading guilty does waive certain things that we all know about. It waives the right to call witnesses on your behalf. It waives your right to a jury trial. What I see Francis is addressing is simply the act of pleading guilty waives those rights. They're saying, no, it doesn't. It waives certain rights that I just articulated and a lot more, but it doesn't necessarily waive the right to a double jeopardy unit of prosecution analysis. What they don't talk about is the fact that, like in this case, the defendant specifically agreed in writing to his offender score, his criminal history, and the scoring forms, and he specifically agreed that they are accurate and complete. And an essential term of this agreement is the party's understanding of the standard sentencing ranges. If the parties are mistaken as to the offender score on any count, neither party is bound by any term of this plea agreement. How is this not violating the plea agreement? Because all of those things that he promised in open court and in writing would be wrong. So if the idea of a reviewing court is to do justice and make sure there's a fairness to it, how would that be just and fair to allow a defendant? In some respects, you could have a disingenuous or dishonest defense attorney who could set up the error, and then if they don't like the sentencing, they could turn around and say, well, unit of prosecution, you didn't catch that, and it doesn't matter that it violated all the terms of our plea agreement, we still can raise it, and we can hold the state to a bargain they didn't agree to. I just don't see how you could say, well, and I would cite two other cases, as I did cite. In Re Shale, the Supreme Court said, a defendant may waive a double jeopardy claim by explicit waiver, or he may do so through his actions in negotiating a plea agreement. How is this not waiving double jeopardy when he agrees to all of these provisions that would be struck or wrong if the unit of prosecution, if all of these other convictions are vacated? And the U.S. Supreme Court said the same thing in U.S. v. Scott. The double jeopardy clause, which guarantees against government oppression, does not relieve a defendant from the consequences of his voluntary choices. They were voluntary choices here. I want to add one last thing, and it has to do with the claim that the state just piles on charges. And you see that argument in every single double or unit prosecution case. The important aspect is two things go into the number of charges, two primary factors. One is, what has the legislature said is the unit of prosecution? That's number one. And then number two is the number of acts the defendant commits. Now, there's all sorts of other factors that may go into that, and we'll ameliorate potential harsh punishment, same course of criminal conduct, continuing course of conduct, exceptional sentence down, the fact that you max out at 9. But just like any crime, once the legislature's defined the unit of prosecution for robbery, burglary, the defendant goes out and commits 60 burglaries, the state permissibly can charge 60 counts. Would we? Not likely. But that's permitted. So to say that we just pile on charges is not accurate, because you've got to look at what the unit of prosecution is first, and then the number of charges is simply dictated by how many crimes the defendant has committed. That doesn't change depending on the statute. That's true for every single statute in existence and every single defendant who commits multiple acts that the legislature has defined as the unit of prosecution. And finally, I would say, how does that square again with violation of a no contact order, which we know each act is a separate charge? So in one case, you can charge multiple acts separately, and in one, you cannot. It makes no sense. Thank you, Your Honors.
One thing I want to get out here is the rule of lenity, which has been, I haven't mentioned that yet today, but I do want to get that out. If Mr. France, if he's presented a reasonable argument, if his interpretation of the statute in terms of unit of prosecution is at least reasonable, then regardless of what the other side's argument is and whether that's reasonable or not, then it's got to be interpreted in Mr. France's favor.
So is the position that the statute is ambiguous for purposes of the unit of prosecution analysis?
If it's ambiguous, if
the is that your position, that it is ambiguous, and so that's why we get to the rule of thumb?
Well, I'm saying at minimum it is ambiguous. I'm not saying it is ambiguous. Mm-hmm. I'm saying that France, full speed ahead, he's got the best argument here on what the statute is. But if this court finds that it is, the statute is ambiguous, then it's got to be interpreted in favor of Mr. France. And I also want to point out that Morales, that was decided a little over 3 years ago, got legislative acquiescence here. We know that the legislature has a history of pouncing on court decisions, which it feels that they didn't get the unit of prosecution right, and then they amend the statute quickly. That hasn't happened in the wake of Morales. That tells us something. Tells us that the legislature has acquiesced in Morales' analysis.
I was surprised nobody petitioned for review.
Me too. But it didn't happen. Turning to the factual prong, I do want to get one other thing out. Kind of my whole point in continuing talking about this is that if we trying to put some meat on how to determine whether factually something holds up on to the unit of prosecution, if we look, we're talking about continuous course of conduct. If we looked at the unanimity cases and the factors there, the analysis driving the unanimity continuous course of conduct cases is an application of common sense to the facts. And that's what Mr. France asked here as well. In those cases, we see situations where the criminal conduct at issue spanning weeks, months, even for the theft case, that's over a year. So the fact that in Mr. Francis' case, we've got this threatening conduct that's taking place over a series of weeks, and there's days separating the individual threats, that's that still meets the continuous course of conduct idea. And that's why I'm pointing to those cases as kind of guidance in terms of how we deal with the issue here. I think I'm done. So we ask this court to find Mr. Francis' favor.
Thank you.
Thank you.